Okay, I'll assume we've more or less got a quorum now. What I want to do this afternoon is maybe change the timetable a little bit, because I think the last session is really interesting. This is interesting too, but maybe it will deserve, this one deserves slightly less time and the last one deserves slightly more, but we'll just see how it goes. Okay, so I want to talk now about liquidity management in banking crises. And as you know, from what we've already discussed and from your background anyway, is that solvent banks can be subject to panic runs and illiquidity that may lead to insolvency. And the first line of defense then, we should argue, is bank liquidity policy. And that's really important. We don't want banks to rely on the authorities. We want them to protect themselves. But lender of last resort can help deal with the liquidity crises, although it has the moral hazard problem. So I'm going to deal with the nature of the problem, the lender of last resort during normal times and in crises. And I'll look at history again, and I say I think it's interesting to do that. In the next lecture on the subprime crisis, what I'll be doing is drawing on all three of the first lectures to see what the subprime crisis shows us in terms of all these various aspects of financial instability. Okay, and if you look in the back, there's one or two papers, in particular Hay, I've given you a link to, the IMF working paper is a good one. Unfortunately, the Holscher and Quinton isn't available on the internet, but I imagine you've got it in your bank library, or you can ask the fund for a copy of it. The Holscher and Quinton is a really nice paper, because it talks about systemic crises in some detail. So those are the background. And there's also the paper I've written, which is referenced, I think, for one of the later lectures. Let me just dig that one up. Got a nice quick internet here. Yeah, if you look on here, it's this one for the fourth lecture, the lender of last resort and liquidity provision. So that's kind of an update for the subprime crisis. Okay. And that was done for Reserve Bank of Australia originally. Okay, banking liquidity risk. Again, a bit basic, but I always think it's good to start from the bases, because otherwise we just assume things that everyone may not be aware of. And even if you do know things, I think it's worth thinking about the bases as well, because it can give new insights, right? So what can we define liquidity risk as? On the one hand, you can't get the full value of the asset when a sale is required, is desired. So, you've got a loan, you know that it's worth X, but you try and sell it, people will only buy it for X minus Y. That's what we call the fire sale problem. If you have to sell a loan, people think it's likely to be a bad one. They think they've got adverse selection. That's illiquidity. Or for a borrower, that your credit's not rolled over, and that's the interbank market problem, or just a general banking liquidity problem, that your depositors have suddenly vanished into thin air. Or an alternative definition, that you are unable to satisfy claims without any impairment of your financial or reputational capital. So, as I say, depositors run, what are you going to do? You try and sell your loans, you can't sell them for full price, that impairs your financial capital. Possible definitions of liquidity. This is more to do with the first definition, the selling one. You've got some sort of fundamental value. What is the discount that you have to that fundamental value? Over time, what is your discount to fundamental value? Or you can do it in expectational terms where, as I say, P is the full value. PI is the price that you actually get. Well, bank liquidity we can define as the, again, as the ability of an institution to meet its obligations under normal business conditions, which of course is to the depositors in particular. Expanding a little on liquidity risk and banking crises, banks have a fundamental maturity mismatch. Their assets are illiquid and long-term, their liabilities liquid and short-term. And as we said earlier, insurance companies, pension funds, mutual funds, most other institutions are not characterized by that sort of mismatch. And an interesting question in banking theory is, why did those sorts of crazy institutions get invented in the first place? And one argument is that the short-term liabilities are a means of discipline of the bank managers, because you issue short-term claims, and if you take risks, then your short-term claimants will withdraw. They can withdraw very quickly, so that's meant to discipline the bank manager against taking high risks. And you can think about this, you know, a sort of 19th century small bank type argument. The problem, of course, especially as banks have grown, is that depositors can't monitor projects. They're likely to be subject to errors, and therefore you may get over-discipline, that the sort of discipline there should be becomes so great that solvent banks are collapsed. And that in turn, because there's no lending available, may lead to socially wasteful liquidation of projects. And of course, the Great Depression was a good example of that. There were hundreds of bank failures, especially in the United States, huge bank failures in Europe as well, like the Kreditanstalt in Austria, all bank runs leading to liquidation of projects, but also an economic recession. And again, the point about contagion, that runs can affect other banks via counterparty exposures. That's the obvious one, that Bank X owes Bank Y money on the interbank market, therefore collapse of Bank X affects Bank Y. But the other one is, if you get a run, then because people are not sure of the balance sheet composition of banks, they don't know the precise risks that there are embedded, then because Bank X has had a run, people think, well, Bank Y looks like Bank X, we better run on it as well. So that's balance sheet similarities under uncertainty. And models of bank runs, you'll all have heard probably of Diamond and Dibvig, who kind of put together the original paradigm. The banks provide liquidity insurance to borrowers, to depositors rather. In other words, that they guarantee that you can always cash out your claims. And those depositors, if they think the assets are going to be inadequate, will run from the bank. And so that was really formalizing the insights that we, in a sense, knew from a long time ago, but in a very nice way. And that article is well worth rereading, I think. On the other hand, Diamond and Dibvig didn't really formalize why people might run from banks. They talked about sunspots, just to complete the model. So people like Chari and Jagannathan made the argument that adverse information is what leads to banking panics. And they argued, I think, that there might be errors in the sense that systematic risks might be inferred from what may be idiosyncratic. In other words, you may have just the odd bank that's in trouble, but that's idiosyncratic. But that could generate systematic risk. Remember, systematic risk is risk of the whole system, a risk that is common across assets. Idiosyncratic risk is what's specific to an individual asset. And what we call systemic risk is a subset of systematic risk, which applies to collapse of the financial system. Just to remind you of that point. Sometimes we call idiosyncratic risk diversifiable risk and systematic risk undiversifiable risk. That's your basic corporate finance that I'm reminding you of. Gary Gorton looked at the 19th century in particular and up till the invention of the Federal Reserve in the First World War, and he found that banking panics were mainly in recessions, which confirmed the adverse information idea, because obviously a recession is when business failures are most common. And then the question arises, well, okay, where do runs take place? And if you read the economics literature, basically they're thinking about a sort of 19th century bank run with a queue of people in front of the bank, and that will be the typical case. And I always joke to my students, because when I was at Brunel, there's always a queue in front of the cash machine at HSBC. So I tell them, you better make sure the queue in front of the cash machine isn't too long, because HSBC might be in trouble, but I don't really think that. Basically, this is an important point. The large wholesale depositors are the key area that you get runs. Why? Basically, as we said earlier, they're better informed and they're less likely to be covered by deposit insurance. And Northern Rock was very unusual. As I said, Northern Rock, we did have a retail deposit, although a retail run, although there was also a wholesale run. In the UK, we've seen wholesale runs on RBS and HBOS, and that was why the government had to rescue them. We just learned last week the Bank of England lent them £62 billion without telling anybody, which I think was jolly sensible, because if they'd told people, they would have run even more. But there you go. Wholesale runs have been very characteristic of this crisis. Northern Rock was very unusual. And historically, the main area of wholesale runs, I think, has been the international interbank market. And there's a nice paper I've referenced there, which you can look at, by Bernard and Bisignano, which is, you get as a link on the website, who talk about the characteristics of the international interbank market. And this is much under researched area as well. There is this whole mass of data from the BIS on international interbank loans and deposits that are really waiting for someone to do some good research on. Anyway, what Bernard and Bisignano showed was that the international interbank market has a lot of very interesting features. And I think this is also characteristic of a lot of domestic interbank markets, as well as the Euro interbank market, which is quasi-domestic and quasi-international. What they pointed out was that you didn't tend to have secured interbank loans, they were unsecured, and banks didn't gather much information. And that might link partly to moral hazard because of guarantees that people thought were there by central banks. The international interbank market has grown because of needs for liquidity due to trading and transactions, over-the-counter derivatives, etc. If you trace through any foreign exchange deal, you'll find there are about a number of different steps of lending required in order to generate the eventual transaction, even. Backup lines of credit have been very famous in the subprime crisis because the banks, remember, had backup lines of credit to the SIVs and conduits that they had to repatriate themselves. So that's important in the IIBM as well. The existence may lead banks to underinvest in liquidity. That's a really crucial point. And I'll tell you some very recent research. When interbank markets were originally invented, what banks thought they were for was for day-to-day liquidity needs, right? They thought they were just things that you could use to cover over the fact that Bank X had assets and Bank Y had liquid liabilities, and next day it might be the opposite. What banks started to do was they moved from short-term liquidity to funding of their assets over a much longer time horizon. And I'm not sure whether this still applies, but at least in the old days, there were some countries in the Eurozone that had huge interbank liabilities vis-a-vis the rest of the Eurozone. And they were using assets, using deposits which were generated elsewhere in the Eurozone to fund their lending. And one indicator of whether banks are doing this is what we call the CDL, the customer deposit to loan ratio. Okay, because we're talking about customer loans as well. The question is, are banks funding themselves from customer deposits or not? If they are, then this ratio is around one, or maybe ideally over one. What has happened though in recent years is that in many countries, banks have wanted to grow loans much faster than they could grow customer deposits. So how did they do that? Basically, they went to the interbank market. They did various other things as well, but they went very much into these sorts of sources of funding. And what we found in research only done last week at the National Institute is that the change in the customer deposit loan ratio is an indicator, an advance indicator of all the financial crises in the OECD since 1980. So that's quite a nice indicator, I think. It may be domestic as well as international, but ultimately, if the whole banking system wants to cut its CDL, then the only people it can borrow from are foreigners. Okay, it can borrow from non-banks as well, of course. But if it borrows from, if it runs out of domestic non-customers, then who is it going to borrow from? It's going to borrow from foreigners, and that means international interbank. So that's the point. It may underinvest in liquidity, but it may also stop funding. When we talk about this, we're also talking about the asset side, of course. They may say, well, why do I bother with liquid assets if I've got all this liquidity in the interbank market? And that's what they did. A range of banks with low credit quality may enter if the lenders believe in the implicit guarantee. And we'll talk a lot about the Asia crisis of 97 in this one. It's subject to quantity and not price rationing. That's what I was saying earlier. Because you don't have much information, you've got a lot of asymmetric information. So as I said, you can't pay up for interbank funds, at least not international interbank funds. Either you have it or you don't. Short maturity makes withdrawal easy, so people get blasé about credit quality, and you get sudden increases in credit rationing during stress due to the asymmetric information, adverse selection and moral hazard that all those features generate. And that can be contagious and lead to global transmission of shocks. Okay, so that's where runs take place. How do we protect against bank liquidity risk? Basically, on the asset side, you hold liquid assets, what we call a net defensive position. Banks don't like holding liquid assets because they think they could make more on loans. So that's something that banks have been reducing over time. There's this frightening chart the Bank of England has showing how liquidity has gone down to almost zero on certain measures in the UK. And the other is on the liability side, that you try to diversify your funding sources, liability management as it's called. The subprime crisis has, if you like, shown the limits of liability management because all the liability sources dried up together. You might look at what they call the volatility ratio, which is reducing the difference between volatile liabilities and liquid assets relative to what are basically your loans, total assets minus liquid assets. And of course, capital adequacy will be a backup to ensure that you're credit worthy when there's a shock. So therefore, supervision has an important role. The supervisors should be keeping an eye on liquid assets. They should be keeping an eye on liability management in order to ensure that the bank is not vulnerable. Reserve requirements, if they exist, can still play a role, although, as Charles Goodhart says, a reserve requirement is only so useful because if you're obliged to have it, then you can't use it when you need it. In fact, the way Charles puts it is this, that you come to a railway station late at night and there's a taxi waiting outside the station. You think, thank heavens, there's a taxi. Can you take me home? And the taxi driver says, no, I'm not allowed to do that because the rule says there always has to be a taxi here. So the taxi is useless. And so this is how Charles describes compulsory reserve requirements if you're in a difficulty. Also the money market infrastructure in order to ensure this liquidity is kept. Briefly, a bit more on liability management, that you're trying to keep continuity and cost effectiveness of your funding. So how do you do that? One is to diversify between all these different types of sources. And you'll see we can have short run like overnight interbank, we can have long run like subordinated debt. But that's what banks were doing. It didn't really work, as we'll see. And then the liability mix between what we call traditional deposits, which are insensitive to the payoffs, and the risk-sensitive ones, which are CDs or longer-term subordinated debt. So a balance there, as well as in maturity. The more maturity matching, the less vulnerable you are to runs. And that's a straightforward point. Okay, so if you like, I wanted to talk about that because if we go straight into lender of last resort, then we're forgetting that we really don't want to use lender of last resort if we can avoid it. So we better make sure the banks do all that stuff properly. But let's suppose we do. What is the lender of last resort? Usually it's the central bank that can produce high-powered money at its discretion in order to support institutions that face difficulties in liquidity, create base money to offset the public desire to switch into money during a crisis, and delay the legal insolvency of an institution, trying to prevent fire sales. Remember, fire sales are trying to sell loans to people who are suspicious of their value, so you can't get value for them. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we've just learned that the Bank of England did a huge lender of last resort to HBOS and Royal Bank of Scotland, equivalent to £60 billion at least, covertly, as it's called, not without without disclosing it. So that was a good example. The Bank of England was able to do that. What it did was apparently it took £100 billion in loans or assets from the banks as collateral. So it was taking a 40% haircut on the loan, on the assets that it took in order to protect itself. But it also took a credit, a treasury guarantee. And apparently the only reason Mervyn King announced this was because the government auditor was going to announce it anyway. So Mervyn King decided it was the right thing to do to describe it. I don't speak anything that's not in the newspapers, by the way. That's quite an interesting development. Okay, so it's discretionary provision of liquidity to an institution, but it equally could be a market as well that has an adverse shock, and so there's a demand for liquidity that can't be got from anywhere else. And it's worth noting that, we'll go on here. The aims of it then are to prevent the individual bank going from illiquidity to insolvency. The lender of last resort should not be lending to insolvent banks. That should be the job of the government, of the deposit insurance, if anything, and not the central bank. And what the Finnish central bank did, from what I understand, in the Finnish banking crisis was that the central bank lent to the savings banks that were insolvent, and the central bank might itself have become insolvent as a consequence. And I think the fiscal authorities sorted that out, but that was an illustration of the dangers that can arise. And so you try and avoid the individual bank collapsing, and you try and avoid contagion that would otherwise happen. And that's the market failure of externality that the lender of last resort is trying to correct. And There is a big economic argument or theoretical argument in the States about whether open market operations are sufficient for lender of last resort. And a good friend, and I've forgotten who the other guy is, argue that there should be only open market operations because the market will rationally help the bank that needs the liquidity. The argument, on the other hand, that most central bankers would say is that the market can't be relied on to do that, so you may need to lend directly. You need to act very quickly because illiquidity can become insolvency, and certainly in the Bank of England there have been lots of weekends when everyone has had to, or everyone who was important was dragged in to resolve something before the markets opened on Monday in order to try and sort out a bank that needed this sort of support or not. And the money markets may need liquidity support as well, particularly since the crises that I've talked about, number two and three, the market liquidity crises, have become more important. So sometimes money markets may need liquidity support as well. And that's something, again, yeah?
I have a question for the second question. From a monetary policy point of view, it's better to have a special ELA or widening the open market operation?
Well, it depends on the situation. If it's a generalized loss of confidence, then you can open, the generalized, you know, situation, the generalized approach is better. But if it's an individual bank that's in trouble and you know it and the market knows it, then I guess the direct emergency lending is better.
But from monetary point of view?
I think that in the end they're going to have a similar effect, aren't they? Because they're an easing of monetary conditions. Which you can sterilize later if that's possible or if that's desired. But in a sense, lender of last resort is always going to be an easing of monetary conditions. It's just you choose your channel. Okay, the costs of lender of last resort are a bit akin to what we talked about with deposit insurance, that firstly you may end up supporting insolvent institutions, like the Finnish case I mentioned, leading to direct costs. Knowing that it exists means that banks get lax on liquidity, and I talked about how liquidity has declined over a long period. And tomorrow when we talk about regulation, liquidity is at the top of the list or near the top of the list of where to get moving again and resolve things after the subprime crisis. It may allow the uninsured to exit the bank. It increases risk taking. Again, especially if the markets are very confident an institution will be saved. It may remove the pressure on the regulators to close the bank very promptly. And we talked about too big to fail already. This is the point we were making, that it may conflict with the monetary policy regime. You may want a tight monetary policy. A bank then gets into difficulty, you have to loosen in a sense by issuing all this liquidity. Maybe you can sterilize it. How long does it take? And it may conflict with fiscal policy too. A big hole in the UK's balance sheet has been due to spending, I don't know, 15% of GDP recapitalizing banks. That's a big hole in the pocket. And this explains why in the UK people are so angry with the banks that are now rewarding themselves with bonuses when the general public have just paid out, and their children and their grandchildren have paid out an enormous amount to keep the banks going. Interesting point. And then there's the cross-border bank issue, which is very real, I think, in Estonia as well as elsewhere in Eastern Europe. Who is the lender of last resort of a cross-border bank? How much can you rely on the home supervisor? Will they support a subsidiary of a bank in your country if it's owned by Austrians or Swedes or Germans? An interesting point again. So how do we minimise those costs? Firstly, make sure that you only support the institutions that are generating systemic risk. Don't rescue unsystemic institutions. And in the UK, in the mid-90s, we let Barings Bank go bankrupt. We let BCCI go bankrupt. There was a lot of discussion about that. In the 80s, on the other hand, we did rescue Johnson Matthey, which was arguably not that systemic. I think the allowing Barings to collapse was actually quite a good policy because it showed we wouldn't just rescue anybody, even if Barings was a wonderful historic name. Only systemic institutions. If there's a non-systemic crisis, make sure you have acceptable collateral, and you may also charge penal interest rates. This is what we call the Bagshot Doctrine, or Bagshot, you've heard of, no doubt. I'll just spell it out for you. He was the 19th century economist who thought of who really originated the doctrine of lender of last resort in the UK after the major crisis of 1866. And the Bagshot Doctrine was lend freely on good collateral at a penal interest rate. Discussion about penal interest rates, of course, because isn't that going to make things worse? So that's a question of debate. But at least ensure the shareholders have made efforts to get support from elsewhere. And you try and get a private solution, if possible, before lender of last resort. So during these weekends, when you're worrying about some bank that's about to collapse, what are you doing? You're desperately ringing all the major banks and saying, are you sure you don't want to buy this thing? Then you might not have to do this sort of emergency liquidity assistance, which is what I would say, you know, another expression for what I'm talking about here. Make sure there's adequate information on financial institutions. And here's the interesting debate on whether the central bank should be the supervisor or not. Goodhart and Schoenmaker wrote a nice paper in the 90s which suggested that there was not much distinction between countries where it was and wasn't the supervisor. I've done some research with a PhD student recently which I think does support central bank as supervisor. I think as a former central banker, I would rather have banking supervision as well, because it means that you don't have nasty surprises in the way that you may suddenly get from your financial supervisory agency. You have to involve the fiscal authorities if the bank may be insolvent, finish point there, and sterilization, that was the point I made earlier, otherwise you may end up with the Indonesia problem. This was 97. They got inflation, capital outflows, and a collapsing currency after they had to rescue the banks. You have to make sure that there are instruments available for these policies, like reverse repos, foreign exchange swaps, deposit facilities. And if you have a currency board, you need excess reserves or some kind of alliance with other central banks. Otherwise, it's not easy to do lender of last resort at all. The lender of last resort raises the issue of transparency and ambiguity. We said earlier that the advantage of lender of last resort over deposit insurance is that it is discretionary. You can decide whether this bank or that bank needs rescuing. And as I said, the more banks you don't rescue, then the less moral hazard there is. So that's a good thing. But on the other hand, you don't want to not rescue the bank that causes the systemic crisis. So that's the fine art of central banking. That's the point there. Decision on a case-by-case basis. Some discussion in these IMF papers about what sort of advance notice do you give? Do you just make it a mystery, which is arguably what the Bank of England has historically done, whether the lender of last resort operates or not? The IMF argue you might spell out what the necessary but not sufficient conditions are. For example, that the bank will be solvent, that it's exhausted available sources of funds, because that would reduce incentives for unnecessary crises, give an incentive for the private sector to stabilise, reduce the risk of forbearance, etc. So that might be a useful thing to do in the lender of last resort policy. And then the question, should you be ex post transparent? Should you announce what you've been doing? And it's clear the Bank of England didn't think it was quite time to announce that this large amount had been advanced to HBOS and RBS. Incidentally, I'm strongly in favour of what they did, as well as in favour of them keeping it quiet for a reasonable amount of time. The argument here is that disclosure is an important aspect of central bank accountability. So they should be telling Parliament what they're doing eventually. So that's the point here, that you need operational autonomy to operate sensibly, but also accountability in order to ensure public support for what you're doing. And that also, if you announce it ex post, at least the banks can judge what the rules are. On the other hand, ex post transparency might help to isolate you from political pressures. That's a trickier one. And maybe if really you don't announce it for a long time, then it was inappropriate. As I say, it depends on how much you trust your central bank, I think, that or the public does, or the government. I think the Bank of England did keep quiet about their rescues in 1991 for maybe 10 years. They ended up making a profit from the operation, so you know, people were happy in the end. And they'd forgotten about the event anyway. So now we talk about normal times versus systemic, and this is in the Holscher and Quinton paper. I think that this distinction is a really important one. Because it changes completely how we should approach liquidity assistance. So if there's an individual bank problem, we have main instruments, for example, discounting paper, advances with or without collateral, or repos of acceptable assets, just different ways of skinning the cat. And the value of collateral should exceed lender of last resort, the UK example I just gave you. They took 100 billion in collateral for a 60 billion loan, so that was a sensible excess. Problems may arise, though, that you may not have sufficient collateral, although hard to think how that would apply. Maybe it had been already given to somebody else. An insolvent one might have lots of collateral but still take risks, so that's where you need good liaison with banking supervision to judge the solvency. Sometimes you might need to suspend the collateral requirement in terms of what assets you take. And of course, in the subprime crisis, central banks have taken a much wider range of collateral than they have historically, except in Europe, where they take anything anyway, from what I understand. Usually in domestic currency, the penal rate argument you should use when in normal times. You should have an implicit price of conditionality, as it's called, that you impose various restrictions on the bank in terms of what it does until things are resolved. And you might have a size limit on lending in terms of the multiples of the bank capital in order to protect yourself. There should be provisions for repayment, where lender of last resort has to be for the short term only, so you can look at the long term from supervision. If there's default, then you nationalise it, of course, or close it down. And this is the confidentiality point. You might want to keep confidentiality to avoid panics, rise in borrowing costs, or loss of reputation. And I think another reason why the Bank of England was confidential about its support in October 2008 was the lesson it learned from September 2007, when basically the support for Northern Rock leaked out. And I don't think the bank actually wanted, well, I think they did eventually want to announce, they wanted to announce it fairly soon. But the knowledge by the public that Northern Rock was getting lender of last resort caused the run. So that illustrates entirely this point here, that if the support for Northern Rock had been kept quiet, maybe it wouldn't have collapsed. There was a stigma attached to lender of last resort support. What about a systemic crisis? We're talking about countries like Sweden, the Asian countries, etc. When we have a panic, flight to quality, and loss of contagion, generally all the nice rules go out the window. We forget about moral hazard and we try and rescue the system at any cost. Because what we're trying to do is reassure the public that there will be a limit to the disorder that's out there. So you announce public in announcement, you are visible. You may need to support all the banks, even if you think they're insolvent, in order to protect the payment system and the economy. And you relax your collateral and solvency requirements. You don't have a penalty rate. So basically, you lend to everybody, everything that moves. And obviously, that's not a long-term solution, but it's something that you need to do if you actually are in the middle of a systemic crisis. Suspending your judgment on which institutions are systemically important, but don't do it on your own. Ensure that the Ministry of Finance is involved, and in particular this point at the bottom here, have blanket deposit insurance guarantees, which then in a sense will limit the need for lender of last resort, because the government is then guaranteeing everything anyway. You may still need LOLR in case of a 100% deposit guarantee if there's a fear of delay, but obviously it'll be less needed in that case. And then you need the government to guarantee the central bank. This point here, that you may need a general macro policy easing in terms of interest rate cuts, because the crisis is a form of tightening. I mean, that's an offset to what we were saying earlier. Lender of last resort is a form of monetary easing, but a financial crisis is a form of monetary tightening, right? Because risk aversion increases sharply, credit availability is sharply reduced, and therefore, in a sense, LOLR and maybe actual interest rate cuts may be needed to keep a constant monetary condition rather than forming an easing. The knife edge thing is whether you get inflation or an exchange rate collapse as a consequence, or whether you somehow resolve the crisis. And when I talk about blanket deposit guarantee, we mean everything. We mean wholesale deposits. We may even need subordinated debt. If there's a dollarized or euroized currency, it may not be easy to do lender of last resort and guarantees. I guess it's not easy if you've got a currency board, because, you know, where do you generate the liquidity from? You may want to comment on that. I think someone told me at lunchtime, you ring the Swedish central bank and tell them to sort it out. Yeah. If the guarantees are insufficient, then you may need to do other things. You might even need to securitize deposits. In other words, forcing people to paying out securities for the amount of deposit. Maturity extension or deposit freeze. That's not the sort of thing we want to do in any economy, let alone an advanced one, are the sorts of things that happened back in the 19th century. Don't make it long-term policy. Make sure you exit, and that's an important discussion going on at present, with withdrawing the liquidity assistance that has been provided since 2007 and 2008. And as far as I understand, the ECB are in advance on that at the moment. They're announcing a faced withdrawal of extra liquidity. The ultimate backup still has to be fiscal policy, that you, the government is the one who's going to recapitalize and close the banks. It's not the central bank's job to do that at all. Any questions or comments? So you all agree with my point about ringing the sweets. Okay, let's look at some examples. I mean, this will be much more, in a sense, when you join EMU, then you'll be part of the system that will be involved in lending of last resort, and there, these things will be, it'll be a regime change, let's say, at least. So I'm talking first as a historic example of a crisis in normal times, I would call it, and that's the collapse of continental Illinois in the US in 1984. Basically, this was a big bank in the States from Chicago, and they had interstate branching restrictions up till the 1990s in the US that meant you could only stay in the state where you were established to take deposits. So what Continental Illinois did was to grow beyond the deposit base of Illinois by using wholesale deposits and international markets, right? So they had a problem with their CDL ratio. Their customer deposits weren't growing as fast as they wanted loans to grow. So supplemented them with wholesale deposits. And they had been lending, unfortunately, to Latin America as well as US energy. We'd already had the Latin debt crisis of 1982 when Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, etc. defaulted on their loans. And so Continental Illinois was vulnerable already, particularly vulnerable. And just as an aside, one thing that's little known is that much of the US banking system was insolvent for most of the 1980s, right? But it was a confidence trick, and so no one said it, and therefore no one did anything about it. So Citibank, Bank of America, if the Latin American loans that were on their books from 1982 to 1988 had been written down to true value, they would have been insolvent. But they didn't write them down, and everyone decided it was in everyone's interest not to take much notice of that. And the process only finished when we had what's called macho provisioning by Citibank in, I think, 1987, when Citibank said, well, we've got enough reserves now to actually provision against these Latin American loans. And then basically the banks created enough provisions to cover the losses. But it could have, I mean, that's an important aspect of why the US actually rescued Continental Illinois, I think, because the Fed knew darn well that all the banks could have been sucked into this because of the Latin American issue, right? Even though it didn't happen. So Continental Illinois started a run in the international interbank market, as we said earlier. Particularly foreign banks started to cut credit lines. So a run in the international interbank or any other wholesale market, remember, is partly a quick thing if you've got overnight funding, but it may be also take a little time if you've got 3 month or even 1 year funding. But it's, you know, every time someone doesn't roll over, you get into more trouble. And US non-banks then began to withdraw as well.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You told that in the 80s, US banks were insolvent.
Yeah.
How big could this issue be now in Europe? Because it's set with commercial bank economists in spring together in one room, and they told that basically the departments which make fixed income, they come up with their money that they can make in the quarter.
Yeah.
And then the other departments come up with a loss, exactly the same amount.
Okay.
To the decimals, basically. Which is a clear sign that they have no clue what's going on. They just write off whatever they can make so that the books look good.
Yes, that's true.
How big is the problem in Europe now?
Yeah, I can't give a good answer to that. What I would say, though, is this, that The reason the Americans were able to get away with it in those days was because of accounting, partly, because we had historic cost accounting in those days. So you kept the loan on the book at historic cost, and nothing much happened until you wrote it off. People might know that it was had to be written down, but you know, there was less force to do it than there is nowadays with mark-to-market accounting. Mark-to-market accounting, or in the case of loans, fair value accounting, and I'm not an expert on this. My understanding is that the losses that banks have made are only half or maybe 60% to do with credit risk and loan losses. There's also big losses due to mark-to-market lowering of valuation of securities. So we've got a double problem compared with America. The mark-to-market, I think, makes it harder to hide these things, I think, is the answer, though. So, although I'm sure the accounts are not showing everything, I suspect that they're showing more of the truth than they did back in the 80s. And we just have to hope that the errors and omissions are not as great as might cause a further crisis. That's all I would say, I think. So Citibank was like a spider in the middle of a web. It had 179 interbank exposures. Was another reason for the concern. So what happened was the Fed got the private sector in for a line of credit. The FDIC, that's the government, put in $2 billion of capital. And the lender of last resort, the Fed, put in $4.5 billion. And that generated a rescue of lender of Continental Illinois, but at a cost, because I think it's arguable that too big to fail began very much with Continental Illinois. People said, look what's happened, this bank is clearly regarded by the authorities as too big to fail, so let's rely on the authorities to support banks in future. What about a systemic liquidity crisis? Here's one that's not studied so much. Mexico, 1994-5. Mexican crisis of 94, sometimes called the tequila crisis. The Mexicans had privatized their banks back in 91-2 at quite high prices. So, in other words, the equity value, the equity owners were desiring a high return in order to compensate them for the high prices they'd paid in the first place. So they sought asset growth, and they reduced the amount of liquid assets, although 27% would seem jolly high to me compared with the UK. So where did the banks do? They came back to this equation again, or this ratio, and they said, we're not happy with how many customer deposits we've got relative to the loans we want. So they funded themselves in the wholesale markets, 63% of their liabilities, volatile in terms of being wholesale, and their funding volatility ratio is quite high, so a lot of it in dollars. Then there was a devaluation of the peso following a speculative attack. The currency went down 56%, and the authorities had to raise interest rates in order to try to stabilize the currency. So you got a currency crisis and then a banking crisis. This is a classic pattern that happens very often. There was a lack of disclosure by the banks. They didn't really disclose their balance sheets, and the different aspects of creditor rights and foreign exchange liquidity made it harder for them to manage their liquidity. And the run, as we said earlier, very much in the international interbank market and international deposit market, refusal to roll over the claims when they were 3 months, for example. So what was the rescue plan? The deposit insurer gave short-term dollar loans at a high interest rate, that were collateralized with government security, $3.9 billion. And the central bank, I think, would lend a further, I'm not sure what the relationship between the, I'm not sure how many billion dollars that is, but that's quite a large amount as well. Relaxation of reserve requirements, so Charles Goodhart's taxi was allowed to leave the station, so the banks could liquidate assets held against volatile dollar liabilities. And The banks were also allowed to create synthetic short dollar positions with derivatives to cover their forex risk. But that was very damaging to the Mexican economy, I might add. But it would undoubtedly have been worse if the authorities hadn't done what they did. So, just to conclude this lecture, liquidity risks, I think, are core to banking, because banks are always involved in maturity transformation. We really need to make sure that they do appropriate liquidity policy, as well as capital adequacy, to prevent any intervention in these markets at all. But it is true that solvent banks can face liquidity problems, so they may need support. So in non-crisis periods, avoid unnecessary failures, safeguard the central bank's balance sheet and minimize moral hazard. In the crisis period, just let things happen, but make sure there's a government guarantee for the central bank. Continental Illinois showed the single bank operation in Mexico, the systemic one, and it has to be temporary. The restructuring of the banks and the corporate borrowers has to happen. Don't rely on this policy for a long time. Any questions there? Is that what I said? Yeah, go on.
Just one question that you mentioned earlier, that the UK banking sector, the share of liquid, or the liquidity construction, the share of liquid assets so strong.
Yeah.
Constantly. And the question is that from the side of the regulators and supervisors, what has been the arguments, or the reasons why they have been quite relaxed about that?
I think you'll have to ask the FSA and the Bank of England about that. I think personally they forgot about it. Because everyone forgot about liquidity, and I don't think they're the sole ones who are responsible. I think everyone forgot about liquidity up to 2007. They said capital adequacy is going to sort everything. You know, why should we burden banks with liquid asset requirements? There was an attempt in Basel in the late 80s, early 90s, to try and have a liquidity agreement like the capital adequacy agreement, and they could not agree on a liquidity requirement. So already then, there was a lack of urgency about liquidity. The central banks and the regulators couldn't agree that there should be an international agreement on liquidity. I think things are different now. So I'm afraid that's all I can say. Okay, shall we stop and maybe restart at 25 to? Then we've still got a 15-minute break, and that will give a little bit longer for the second lecture, if that's okay.